The Boston Celtics scored a 107-94 win over the Cleveland Cavaliers, and they are now 2-0 up in their Eastern Conference Finals series.
Woohoo! I'm happy about that. And Suns fans are happy about how the draft lottery panned out.
And can the Houston Rockets do better and try and beat the Golden State Warriors and even up their series? It is the Wednesday edition of Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Locked On NBA. As always, I'm your co-host, Jake Madison, at Nola Jake on Twitter, editor over at LockedOnPelicans.com, credential member of the media, and just all-around Pelicans insider.
There you go. And I am John Corrales, Reds Army underscore John on Twitter. I am the co-host of the Locked On Celtics podcast, co-founder of RedsArmy.com, and a contributor to the Boston.com Celtics coverage.
John, you've got to be feeling pretty good. 107-94, you're up 2-0 on the series. You were just here partying in New Orleans. Life's got to be pretty good right now.
I feel okay. Things going all right. Life's good. Celtics, they withstood the initial blow from LeBron tonight, who had a monster 42-point, 12-assist, 10-rebound game. But if you didn't see the game, he did a tremendous amount of damage in the first quarter. He had 21 points in the first quarter. He was aggressive. He was everything that Cavs fans wanted him to be. That first quarter was almost everything that they wanted that quarter to be. The Celtics kind of struggled to shoot in the first quarter. LeBron was a monster. The Celtics kind of didn't have their footing until Jaylen Brown kind of went off. And it turned into a little bit of a Jaylen Brown, LeBron James duel. From a Celtics perspective, what happened in the first quarter where LeBron scored 21 and the Celtics came out only down 4, set the tone for the rest of the game. And they came out in the second half and had a monster third quarter from Terry Rozier. And then Al Horford and Marcus Smart combined in the fourth quarter to just shut down the Cavs. The Cavaliers only scored 39 points in the second half. And the Celtics looked good. And this goes along.
They looked really good. It's not even look good. They looked really good.
They looked really good. And I said, if anybody had listened to the Lockdown Celtics podcast, I'm going to pat myself on the back a little bit. I said, going into this series against this particular Cavs team, you can withstand an early shot from LeBron. If he comes out like he did tonight, he's going to fade later on. He's going to settle for jumpers later on. If he's expending all of this energy trying to set the tone, you have a very high probability of him kind of settling for jumpers and trying to shoot the Cavs to the end of the game. I don't care if LeBron scores 50. If you hold the rest of the Cavs under 50, you have a chance to win. LeBron had 42. The rest of the Cavs had, 54. So, or 52. So it all kind of works out average-wise. And you stay home on the shooters and then you take advantage of the matchups that you have on the wings, which the Celtics do. You can't stop both Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown. The Cavs defense is just not good enough. No, and LeBron has to make decisions and he doesn't have any help.
No, and their defense is not good. And they haven't been good all year long. And if you looked at their defensive rating in this game, it basically matches up with what it was on the season. The Celtics only had six total turnovers in this game. You're not going to get that done if you can't force them to turn the ball over in this one. I think it was the Cavs had kind of the same amount of possessions and everything for the most part, which it's obviously going to be. There was a stat that I just lost that I had, so forgive me here. But basically, they were so inefficient. And defensively, they were just letting Boston kind of do what they wanted. They got a number of offensive rebounds. And when you have no one else really showing up a ton in this series other than LeBron for you, you're not going to win. Yeah, Kevin Love had 22 points in this game, but you absolutely felt like he needed to have way more than that. Tristan Thompson's given you 8-7 in this game, so what? J.R. Smith goes 0-7. George Hill's 1-4. Larry Nance Jr. goes 0-for-1. Jeff Green's playing almost 30 minutes. Korver's not scoring enough. Like, what are they supposed to do here?
That's the problem. I think if you look at the distribution of the scoring, if you just look at the box score itself, you say, you know, a bunch of the Celtics had nice games. But I think really where you get the crux of what the problem is for the Cavs, in the first quarter, it was Jaylen Brown who had 14 points. And the second quarter, in the third quarter, I should say, it was Terry Rozier who had 14 points. I totally skipped over the second quarter because my stats kind of went off the screen. But in the second quarter, it was Jason Tatum who led the Celtics. He had 9 points in that quarter. In the fourth quarter, it was Al Horford who had 8.
He closed out that game for him, it felt like.
After a dirty play by J.R. Smith.
Yeah, which, that was bad. There's no getting around that. If DeRozan's ejected for what he did, how J.R. Smith isn't is kind of beyond me. And there's just no need for anything like that.
No, totally. Defenseless, not a play on the ball. That I'm surprised it was only called a flagrant one. I would expect him to get suspended, heavily fined, something. I think that would get upgraded, which from a actual game perspective kind of sucks for the Celtics because J.R. Smith has been so terrible that we want him on the floor. But back to my original point is four different Celtics, and then not mentioned in the scoring, but a big factor down the stretch was Marcus Smart making our quote-unquote winning plays. The Celtics got major contributions from five different players. The Cavaliers got major contributions from one. They got a really good game from Kevin Love from the other, but never, ever thought that Kevin Love was really taking over at any point. His points kind of spread out throughout the game. Like, he had a nice 7-point second quarter. He had an 11-point third quarter. Okay, that was good. But at no point did I think, oh, God, here comes Kevin Love. Now it's his turn. So the big problem going into game three is, can the role players, and you know that cliche about role players playing better at home, can they give the Cavaliers anything to outscore the Celtics? Because their defense is so terrible, there's just no stopping Boston unless they miss shots. Basically, you're hoping that Terry Rozier and Marcus Morris and those guys miss shots on the road and miss enough where George Hill catches fire. Jeff Green has one of those magical games that he has every once in a while. Rodney Hood wakes up. That's the only way they're going to win. And I don't know if that's enough for them to win four out of the next five games.
No, I don't think so. And that's really what they're banking on. Maybe LeBron now has, 3 days to rest up, and maybe he comes in big. And, like, I want to say it's feels like we've been here before where LeBron kind of lulls you into this where it's like, okay, you know, I didn't win on the road, no big deal, we'll go back home. And until you really win one in Cleveland, I wouldn't say this thing is kind of got the door shut on it yet, but it feels like you're getting there because those role players just aren't doing well, and I'm not sure what Tyronn Lue can do to kind of wake these guys up. You know, you've got to wonder why Clarkson didn't play in this one. You've got to wonder about some of the minutes distribution for these other guys. And if you're just hoping they're going to play better at home, well, you only got 3 games at most at home in this series, so that's not really going to help you here.
Yeah, well, Clarkson was so bad in game one.
He was.
That he earned that glue on the bench. But at the same time, you need somebody like Clarkson to come in and you just got to be like, you were horrible. Come in and be better. And this is where I think Ty Lue, I don't know what he's going to get from these guys. Clarkson's, you know, playing and then he's not playing. Larry Nance, who I thought might be some sort of an X factor in this game, got the minutes but didn't do some of the athletic things that I thought he might do. Tristan Thompson was a nice adjustment that kind of paid off a little bit at first and was part of why the Cavaliers took a lead, but not quite the monster adjustment that a lot of people thought. You just got to understand that this is not the Cavaliers teams of the past. This is not the Cavaliers team in the Tristan Thompson that dominated Al Horford and on the glass last season. This is not the Cavaliers team that came back from 3-1 down in the finals. They just do not have that level of help. So the only hope that they have is that some of these other guys catch fire at home, some of the Celtics role players cool off on the road, and that you can at least extend this to a game 7 and hope that LeBron can LeBron his way to a game seven win? That, I think, is their only hope. But it's more hope than anything, because on the court, I know I'm coming at it from a Boston perspective, but I see matchup problems that favor the Celtics. I see guys that can't be stopped. I see a Cavs defense that has no idea how to defend a pick and roll or a pick and pop with Al Horford. And I see guys like Marcus Smart getting past that initial line of quote unquote defense, getting into the paint, getting paint touches, Jaylen Brown driving at will without even needing a pick, Tatum doing the same thing. Smart's distributing the ball. These other guys are scoring. I don't see how the Cavaliers can stop the Celtics enough to win now. Like I said, you got to win 4 out of 5 games and you got to steal one on the road now. I just don't see it. I don't think they have that level inside of them.
No, I don't think so either. And you could kind of see that the level just wasn't even going to show up in this one, where Marcus Smart was winning every single 50-50 ball, given that extra effort. And the Cavs just had no one to kind of match that. And when he's going out and doing that, it kind of makes that whole team click a little bit more. And they just had no answer whatsoever. They come out of this looking just bad. You know, I was taking notes on it, and I'm just kind of writing down like, this is bad, this is bad, this is bad. And like, maybe that just kind of sums it up right now.
Yeah, it's bad. It's bad for Cleveland. And it's, you know, it's amazing to me that these Celtics are 2 wins away. But you talk about Marcus Smart getting 50-50 balls. Marcus Smart gets 70-30 balls that should go to the Cavs.
That's a good way of putting it.
And he still somehow gets his way to find he lost the ball on one possession, volleyball spiked it to Marcus Morris for a basket, got a steal, got it back to Morris, and then he had a play later on where he had a tap out to keep the ball alive, followed up a miss with a free throw, with a tip in, and it's just, he does these crazy things. We like to call him winning plays in Boston. He's an X factor. And I'll end my analysis on this. Marcus Smart making those plays is one of 2 examples of why the Celtics are just better in this series. It's that, and in the first quarter, Al Horford switched on to George Hill on a play really early on, somewhat inconsequential, but Hill spent 10 seconds or so trying to dribble his way into some sort of advantage against Al Horford. He started on the left side of the floor. He went all the way to the right side of the floor. Horford stuck with him, didn't lean, didn't hesitate, didn't give him an opening. He funneled Hill to the baseline. Then Hill tried to go on the other side of the rim, and Horford rejected the shot. So that's your center picking up the other team's point guard, defending him extremely well for 10 seconds on the floor.
It's like not a mismatch there, actually.
And blocking the shot. That's exactly it. He can do that for stretches. He can pick up the point guard on a switch and be very good defensively. The only player that can do that on the Cavaliers is LeBron James. And the rest of the guys are just too confused. And when it comes down to being down at the end of a game, the team that can defend is the team that can come back. And the Cavs, I don't know if they have the ability to come back whenever they fall behind, because they can't get the stops. So that's why I think they're in trouble.
Yeah, I think that sums it up really well. And if, you know, people thought their night was bad on the court, and it was, they didn't get much help off the court, which we're going to touch on in one moment here. But first, make sure you are all listening to Locked On NBA 5 days a week, recapping the games from the night before, previewing the upcoming games, and talking about all the biggest stories going on around the association. This offseason is never going to stop, I think, so make sure you're subscribed and listening to Locked On NBA 5 days a week. So we had the NBA draft lottery last night, and like we said, things didn't go well for Cleveland, which I think most of us are happy about, but it did go well for a number of teams. finishing number one overall was the Phoenix Suns. Two, the Sacramento Kings jumping up into the top three. Atlanta, the Hawks finished with the third overall pick. Memphis Grizzlies at four. Dallas Mavericks at five. The Orlando Magic at six. Chicago Bulls at seven. Cleveland Cavaliers at eight from that Brooklyn pick from that Kyrie Irving trade. New York Knicks at nine. I know you're laughing about how that changed. We're going to touch on that because I think that's an interesting part of this. New York Knicks at nine. Philadelphia at 10 from the Lakers, also via Boston. The Charlotte Hornets at 11. You've got the Clippers at 12 and 13, 12 pick from Detroit in the Blake Griffin trade. And then the Denver Nuggets, and this is the team I'm happiest that didn't really jump up, finishing at 14. So let's touch on it because, like I said, the Cavs had a bad night on the court. And that Brooklyn pick, not being the fancy top three pick that I think a lot of people might have thought it was going to be, but then you could see Brooklyn was improving and might not end up there. This looks bad in that Kyrie Irving trade now.
I got to laugh because Danny Ainge does it again. I've criticized him before. I can't say anything because he sees things and you're like, I don't get it, Danny. But at this point, I learned to completely trust him. Whatever he says, whatever he does, even if I think it's complete trash, I have to sit there and say either he knows something that I don't. Because in that trade, the Cavs got the Brooklyn pick, Isaiah, they got Jay Crowder, Ante Zizic, and what else? That's it. So all of those players except for Ante Zizic are gone. They've in return gotten Larry Nance, George Hill, and Rodney Hood, and they've got what turned out to be the eighth pick. So if you look at tonight's game, you've got three guys who combined for 3 points in a conference finals game for you in this trade. Ante Zizic, who didn't play, and you got the eighth overall pick before that. That is as disastrous a trade for a star player as you're going to get.
Yeah, it's not great. And yeah, I mean, that sums it up. That looks even worse now. And I mean, make of it what you will. And of course, hindsight's kind of everything here. But that doesn't look ideal for them whatsoever. So they're obviously the big losers, in my opinion. If we can pick wins and losers in the draft lottery, which is kind of a silly thing to do, but we're going to do it anyway, because why not?
Sure, why not?
This is what people want. Do you have a big winner in the draft lottery? I don't think we want to call it the Suns because they were projected to get the number one overall pick.
Yeah, but at the same time, this is the team that hired a potential number one overall pick's former coach. So you have potentially a reunion in Phoenix for Doncic and Kukushkov. So I think that is a win, and they have the opportunity there to do a lot of things. Even if they trade down, I'm going to give the Suns the win just because of the serendipitous result, considering their coaching hire.
Yeah, no, I think that has to make him the presumed number one overall pick, even though
you would think, right?
Yeah, but I don't know. DeAndre Ayton might be a little bit better suited for them, and this is getting into way too early mock draft territory, I guess, which we don't want to do since the combine starts tomorrow, and we'll start getting workouts and all of that leaking out, which is going to be pretty fun. But, you know, it seems like, you know, Luke is going to fit with Devin Booker in the backcourt. You do have his Slovenian national team coach there. That makes a lot of sense. But Ayton at that center, kind of replacing, you know, Tyson Chandler, Alex.
I gotcha.
You know, it makes a little bit of sense there. And also, like, the Kings moving up to two, I don't trust them to take another big at two and not screw it up.
Right, well, there is that. I guess if I just wonder sometimes. In drafts, drafting just for specific fit is where you get into a little bit of trouble. Like the Portland Trail Blazers had Clyde Drexler, so they said we're not going to draft Michael Jordan, and they ended up getting Sam Bowie because they needed a center, and we know what happened. Now, that's obviously the most extreme, egregious example, but I think there are plenty of examples of that that have happened over the course of time. Sometimes you just got to take the guy that you think is the transcendent talent. And I'm not 100% sure. I haven't seen him play, but if especially with his former coach, if you think a guy like that who's big and can shoot and can pass and can do all of those things, and you say, but we've got Elfrid Payton. No.
Well, no one's saying that.
Right.
Let's be clear there.
So I think you kind of go with the supreme talent and then you figure it out.
Yeah, especially on a rebuilding team.
Where, yeah.
You know, there's maybe a few teams here that might go for fit, but I think for the most part, especially at the top of the ladder, you've just got to go best player available and take the most talent because that's what you're going to need on this. I want to ask you about one thing going back to the Cavs, though. Is there any way, if Trae Young's available at 8, the point guard out of Oklahoma, that they don't take them, even if it's just to maybe try and keep LeBron James and pair him with a guy that he's knows of in college?
Yeah, look, they can go with a guy to fill a need. It's hard to say what's going to keep LeBron there because basically everybody fills a need on the Cavs, right? I mean, what do the Cavs – we just talked about them for this whole game. You could use Mo Bamba if he's available. Like, you could use anybody to fill any because everybody needs an upgrade except for Kevin Love. And who knows what they're going to do with Kevin Love at this point. So whoever is available down there, it might be Trae Young. But basically anybody that you get down there is going to help. I think – honestly, though, I'm coming at it from a very Celtics perspective. Anytime you can get a wing in today's NBA, if there's a tiebreaker between, if there's a transcendent ball handler or just knockdown shooter, like just completely automatic, maybe you could consider that. But if there's a switchy kind of defensive minded point guard that can do a lot of things, that positional versatility, I think, is just much more highly regarded. And you look at the teams that have drafted successfully, even like I said with the Celtics, picking Tatum over Fultz, picking Jaylen Brown a couple years ago third, when people are like, why would you take him? Why are you loading up on forwards? Now you get to see, I think, the positional versatility that is so highly regarded. It's basically the Celtics and the Warriors who have kind of set this blueprint. So I think those wings are going to be more highly valued. And I feel like as we move forward and we'll see how the workouts go, that those wings are going to be the guys that tend to go higher than some of those kind of ball handlers. There's so many guards in the NBA. I think you can get that production somewhere else.
Yeah, no, I think that makes sense too. And you mentioned another guy I'm really high on in this top of the lottery is Mo Bamba. That is going to be a legit rim protector and almost potentially as a ceiling, a 3-point shooting Rudy Gobert, I think, is maybe a good projection for him, which is a terrifying thing. But as we said, this is a way too early to start really diving into that. So that's something we're going to touch on here on the Locked On NBA podcast in the weeks to come. Giving you guys another reminder to make sure you subscribe and listen to it daily, 5 days a week. No one else giving you these quick recaps, diving into the topics of the day, and previewing the games that coming night. So make sure you subscribe to Locked On NBA. All right, we got game 2 of the Houston Rockets taking on the Golden State Warriors. Game 1 was a 119-106 win for Golden State. And despite being the underdog somehow in game 1, this went basically like what people thought.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of like, this is it. This is exactly what we thought. Like the Rockets are really, really good. But they it's a testament to the Warriors how good they are that a team that's been as historically good as the Rockets has to play perfectly for them to close out a game and make it competitive. Like it was close, but they got waxed in the second half and ended up losing by 13 at home because Chris Paul didn't have the Chris Paul closeout game against Utah. because guys like Trevor Ariza and PJ Tucker and Eric Gordon didn't have their types of complementary games. You know, those types of things, you need something from everybody in this series. And it's kind of disappointing from the Rockets' perspective that even at home, where these guys are supposed to do these things, they couldn't, because the Warriors just have too much firepower, that even on a game where Steph Curry wasn't exactly Steph Curry, they just ran away with it. Too many defensive lapses. Klay Thompson got a ton of open looks.
Well, especially in the corners, you can't let him get to those spots and get those shots off. And it was Harden not closing out at times, not having the court awareness. And like you said, this was the game that they were supposed to play well in and maybe kind of spook the Warriors a little bit, and they weren't able to do it. And, you know, Ariza and Tucker and Eric Gordon and all those guys didn't play particularly well because it was the defensive game plan of the Warriors to come in and just go, okay, we're going to clamp down on you guys. We're going to take away Clint Capella, which I think you and I both want to talk about in a moment here. And we're going to let James Harden do his thing. And Harden had 41 points. And that still isn't enough. It's kind of like the game that happened tonight, or last night, depending on when you're all listening to this, between the Cavs and the Celtics. Yeah, they can withstand a 40-plus point game from the opposing team's best player because they're going to make sure no one else does anything in this series.
Yeah, when you have lapses, the number I think I heard was 54 points on wide-open looks for the Warriors. That's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It's half their points, more, a little less than half their points. That you can't give the Warriors those looks. It's the most obvious thing anybody can say.
Yeah.
But when you're the Houston Rockets and you've spent this entire season building up to this moment, there, you can't have lapses in communication. This isn't like you're a new team. You've spent the entire year together. You can't have miscommunications that lose Klay Thompson. You can't have miscommunications that give the Golden State Warriors open looks. You have to at least challenge them, which means defensively, you have to be absolutely 100% on top of your game. Now, again, I'm looking from a Celtics perspective. They played tonight. Why do these great defensive teams have that level of cohesion? There's a person in the back like Al Horford or Draymond Green that's communicating and getting people to be where they're supposed to be. And I don't know if Clint Capella is that guy. I don't know if he's there yet. You got to be able to see the floor and be a defensive floor general. I saw it with Kevin Garnett, one of the best defensive players I've ever seen, one of the best defensive players ever in the NBA. When you're behind there as a five, seeing everything, you have to be aware what's happening, who's setting the pick, switch, what are you doing, are we icing, how are we doing this? You got to be the guy that communicates and lets everybody know. The one thing that everybody was talking about after the Celtics game one win was their ability to switch, not just the picks, but once the Cavaliers had a mismatch in the post and Kevin Love had Terry Rozier on his back, as the pass was being made, they switched and Jason Tatum or Jaylen Brown would come on over and guard Kevin Love as he was catching the ball. That is awareness. That is communication. The Rockets, as good as they've been and as active as they've been all season defensively, I don't think they have that level of communication to really take it to the next level against an offensive juggernaut like Golden State.
See, I actually don't know if I think that's the issue, but that's a really good point, too. One, you actually have to get some defensive stops against them, and you've got to force them into more than 9 total turnovers, because if they're not turning the ball over, they're not going to miss shots, and then you're hoping to rely on variance, which just we've seen isn't a good plan against this team because they defy it again and again and again. I thought, and I think this is kind of the raging debate about them right now, was do they go back to the drawing board and mix up their offense that we all know is very isolation heavy? They were they have passed the ball the fewest amount of times per game during the regular season. Their identity is this. It's gotten them here, and it's gotten them very far to this point. So do you abandon your isolation heavy offense in favor of something a little bit different, or do you just kind of keep going the course that's gotten you here, knowing that, yeah, that's probably not going to be good enough because this Warriors team actually knows how to defend that. They've got length at every position. They've got so many all-stars out there. And then they have Draymond Green, who's upped his defense tremendously in the playoffs from the regular season. So you're kind of screwed either way. You can keep doing what you've done all year, which you've been successful against basically any other team, or do you mix it up and then risk what might happen with that?
See, I look at the Rockets scored 106 points. They gave up 119. You're not going to win games giving up 119 points. I know it's the Warriors, but that's just how it is. You have to find a way to get them down into the low 100s. That the 106 is not the worst number when you consider all you need to get is a little bit better production from Trevor Ariza and PJ Tucker. Just a couple of baskets apiece. Just get those guys a couple of those shots. And it doesn't require abandoning the whole offense. Just requires maybe some minor tweaks, calling some certain plays every once in a while. And that's D'Antoni, and that's Chris Paul. You got to figure out when those guys need to get their looks and just get away, not for the whole game, just a little bit. Because this is what got you here offensively, and they can score a ton of points that way. Harden needs to just understand sometimes that he can't just do step back threes all the time. He's got to understand that sometimes he's got to be able to drive, and maybe you get Capella more lobs and stuff like that. Maybe go to some of that a little bit more, but I wouldn't overhaul the offense. No. To me, it's defensively.
No, I wouldn't either. But, you know, getting Capella more lobs is something I think they have to try and do. But Golden State in game one did a really good job of taking that away, where Draymond Green was covering Capella down low. And anytime Harden drove, he took a step out at Harden like he was going to switch over and play some help defense. Harden looks to get the lob, and then right before he does that, Green just takes a step back and takes that away and forced him into a turnover or like an off-balance shot from Harden, and it was a bit of a disaster. And you and I have talked all season long whenever we brought up the Warriors that Capella's kind of the key to making them really work. And with him being just kind of marked out of the game like that, I think that's a disaster for them. And if you look at, you know, the starters, Capella was, in terms of plus-minus, the best at only -3 compared to the rest of them, which I think kind of speaks to that point a little bit more.
Yeah, no, look, for Houston, you need to get contributions from Capella, because he is, like I've said before on the podcast, the puzzle piece, the perfect puzzle piece for them. When he's going well, the whole thing's going well. So absolutely, he's a focus. But I just look at Draymond Green getting 9 assists, and that's what Draymond does. You gotta take something away from the Warriors. Go down the list of what can you take away from the Warriors. You're not going to take away Kevin Durant. He's just awesome.
There's no answer for that anywhere in the league.
Right. You can't, you know, Curry, who knows what if he's feeling the lingering effects, whatever. You're going to deal with that. But Draymond Green getting past you defensively, getting into the middle of the lane and making passes, and a lot of those times it ended up going out to a wide open Klay Thompson. Those miscommunications, or at least understanding that there are rotations behind you that you have to trust, and those guys have to make those right rotations. That to me is where you can at least make this a series. You gotta find a way to contest Klay Thompson. Something that's the difference to me. Maybe he doesn't score 28. Maybe he scores 22, and that 6 points gets you. Now you're within six, and if you can find 6 points the other way, you're evening things up. It's just a couple of shots here and there from Thompson that were wide open that you got to find a way to defend, and a couple of shots that you can try to find for Trevor Ariza and some of these other ancillary guys, Eric Gordon, and that is enough to kind of close the gap to me. I'm just so focused on the defense. That's the only way to me that the Rockets are going to come back and make this a series.
And they cannot afford to go down 0-2 with those two games being home. Otherwise, they are toast.
They might get swept.
Then you're looking at this as being over fast. So it's going to be fun to watch, because I think everyone wants this to be a series, and no one wants another just dominant Warriors run. So we're going to see if they're able to do that tonight in the one game that we've got going on, and hopefully maybe they can even it up unless you're a Warriors fan, in which case, yeah, 2-0 sounds really good there. So thank you all for listening. As always on Wednesday, I'm your co-host Jake Madison at Nola Jake on Twitter and the host of the Locked On Pelicans podcast.
I'm John Corrales, Reds Army underscore John on Twitter and the co-host of the Locked On Celtics podcast.
Thank you all again for listening, and we'll be back with you all next Wednesday.